Hi, I'm Congressman Ro Khanna, and you're listening to Trust Me. I know what I'm doing.
Yeah. My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Hello, everyone. And on this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, a conversation with United States Congressman Ro Khanna. Stay tuned. So once again, I truly want to thank you for listening to this right now and for sharing with your friends and family. If you're enjoying the episodes, then a kind review and rating is always appreciated. And thanks also for following Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing on social media at Dr. Abhay Dandekar. Now, I've always understood that the ultimate civic trust belongs with the individuals who represent us, steering policy and solidifying future directions. In the U.S., the Indian American and South Asian American population have grown tremendously, and the expectation of a civic trust through those we elect to office is a vital companion to this, not just at the local level, but at the national level. In 1957, Representative Daleep Singh Sondh became the first Indian American elected to Congress, and since then, there have been more than seven members of Congress who are Indian Americans. And as May is Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, it's a great time to highlight the importance of why this matters in government. So I was grateful to share a conversation with United States Congressman from California's 17th District, Ro Khanna. Ro was born in Philadelphia as the son of immigrant parents and the grandson of an Indian freedom fighter. After getting his law degree at Yale, Ro worked in President Obama's administration as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce. He then moved to California and taught economics at Stanford and practiced law in the heart of Silicon Valley, getting a front row seat to the tech industry and garnering more expertise as he authored books on entrepreneurship and manufacturing. After an unsuccessful bid for Congress in 2014, he successfully won the race for California's 17th District in 2016 and now is serving his fourth term. Ro's been a progressive leader on a range of issues from climate and tech to labor and term limits to healthcare and stopping gun violence. He serves on a number of committees and is the co-chair of the Congressional Caucus on India and Indian Americans. Now, it's not a secret that Congress and the U.S. government can sometimes appear to be, well, paralyzed by politics and a lack of cooperation. So it was nice to catch up with Ro as he was walking back from a vote on Capitol Hill to his office and get a real snapshot of the temperature and tone of his service as an elected official, trying to represent his district, his party, and his own vision. Our conversation was pretty broad, touching on his views on economic patriotism, to manufacturing and tech, to current and future senators from California, and being an Indian American in 2023. But to set the stage, I was reminded that we were simply two Bay Area dads who happened to be basketball fans. Beyond just the appreciation and gratitude for all your service and all you do, it's just great to have another chat with a Bay Area Indian American dad. One Warriors fan, one Lakers fan, and unfortunately now we're both watching on the sidelines, I think.
Well, yeah, it looks like the Denver Nuggets are pretty dominant. I thought we had a good run, but the Lakers ultimately proved too difficult. But I still have hope that Curry and Thompson and all will be back. We'll see what Draymond Green.
Yeah, we'll see how if they can hold it all together. I wanted to ask you, of course, you're walking back from a vote, and especially with the backdrop of so much going on right now, negotiations on Capitol Hill. And I wanted to chat about that backdrop and the fronting prospect of your own philosophy. And I wanted to find out, can you have a true economic patriotism in the future if we can't agree on how to account for paying off yesterday's debt?
Well, it certainly is a challenge in the current context. I had a bill with Marco Rubio that would call for economic development in rural America, on factory towns, in communities of color. And that shows that the idea has bipartisan appeal. But the current House Republican Party is not interested in constructive legislation. So it's going to take President Biden or some leader to have a sweeping win in a presidential election, an Obama-like mandate that captures and excites the imagination of the American public. Until we have something like that, it's very hard to implement.
Do you think that the roadblock to this is sheer political morass, or is there something deeper going on, especially when it comes to really kind of doing common sense things, or for that matter, you know, the option of using that 14th Amendment?
Obviously, there are people who are concerned about the deficits and spending, and I think that that may come from a sincere place. But the fact that they're willing to hijack the entire country and take hostage the country, that comes from an extremist brand of politics, where the Republicans think that confrontation and these extreme fights will accrue to their benefit. And it accrues to their benefit with their base, but it really turns off many other Americans. So unfortunately, the modern Republican Party is perpetually fighting a primary battle as opposed to focusing on governance.
Can I ask you about that? I mean, you're someone who's now been so successful in the campaign and election front, but is it inevitably a unfortunate reality that after each election is won, the campaign for the next one begins, and therefore every one of your actions is constantly part of your next election cycle, and therefore does it make it just that much harder to govern?
Well, it's true that you always are worried about elections and raising funds and building support. And that's unfortunate because it doesn't give you enough time to think and legislate. But it shouldn't lead to dysfunction. I mean, the fact that you have perpetual accountability by voters should mean that people are willing to get things done and compromise and have something to take back to voters. I think what's making the process dysfunctional is a primary electorate that often is very small and out of touch with where the median voter is, and also the role of special interest money swapping politics.
Let me ask you this. I've been reading some of your work and some of your opinion editorials. Is there a bigger cultural tension to solve? If it's politically important to try and tap into a modern revival of the kind of factory culture with good union jobs, but a reality that AI and automation and tech are really the currency of progress in almost every sector.
Well, I think the two are related. I actually think AI and digital technology, sensor technology, will be critical in building the modern factories and helping us increase our productivity so that we can have an American production renaissance, not just in terms of manufacturing and factories, but in terms of all types of jobs, having a home care worker with the technology that allows them to monitor their patients, having retail workers who are able to have a better understanding of the market. I think what we have to use is the technology to improve people's outcomes.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand that with a kind of hearkening back to better days where manufacturing towns and in many ways rural America, or for that matter, the sort of industrial belt, they were enjoying that kind of success, but those jobs have gone away. That culture has gone away. How do you spark the idea that you can accelerate a revival of this when a lot of times the education is lagging behind and even the sort of vocational support for people to engage in these kinds of jobs and rebuild that culture in the sort of 21st century?
Well, at first, we have to show that we're taking a manufacturing renaissance seriously, that we're bringing these jobs back. Only then will people want to go into it or have their kids go into it. We have to show that these are modern jobs that require complex robotics, complex understanding of technology, that are often environmentally clean, that aren't going to pollute the environment, that doesn't mean back-breaking labor, and that it can help sustain a local community. And then we need to make the investment in workers to be on the factory floor and to be running these factories.
Mm. Do you think that people so far, I mean, you know, we've seen so many cycles of this. Do you think people are just not ready for it? Is the substrate not there? What's stopping us, aside from, of course, the political will to do this?
I think historically the United States has discounted the importance of manufacturing. We haven't focused on place-based policies. We've just let the macro economy succeed and haven't focused on the impact on local communities. And we haven't made the investment in scaling industry. Mm. We often are so focused on inventing things. We're not focused on scaling things.
Is when you mentioned that these are clean jobs and these are, you know, environmentally sound and environmentally conscious opportunities for us, that's where I think straddling perhaps the political landscape is tough, especially in deeply red states. So how have you been in some ways successful at reaching across the aisle or building partnerships and collaborations in endeavors like this?
Well, I look for themes which can cut across the aisle. We want to make sure America leads the world in technology. We want to make sure America is a manufacturing superpower. We want to make sure America's economy is preeminent. We need to rebuild our factory towns. We need to rebuild economies in rural America. And I try to partner on those initiatives with Republicans, even though we disagree on choice, even though we disagree on gun violence, even though we disagree on trans rights.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with Ro Khanna. Stay tuned. Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, this is Cal Penn. I'm an actor, author, former public servant, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation with United States Congressman Ro Khanna.
You know, we're in the middle of Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and speaking of that, you have a front row seat to this, but in the same vein of bridging some divides, how do you connect the dots, perhaps, between the South Asian American tech professional in Silicon Valley and, say, the truck driver in the Central Valley, especially in a 2023 when it seems like their worlds are moving farther and farther apart?
Well, even driverless trucks will require a lot of truck drivers. The truck drivers will now maybe not be in the cab of the semi or the truck, but they will be in a remote center helping direct these trucks. They will be the technicians helping fix these trucks and maintain these trucks. There will be in the safety check, making sure that the trucks are safe. So the idea that just automation is going to eliminate all these jobs is not correct. It may transform jobs, and then it's for us to make sure that the truck drivers themselves have a say in that transformation.
And these are, you know, perhaps constituents and friends that are in our own kind of South Asian American community, and even for that matter in California. Have you heard conversations and that makes you more optimistic that both of those people, the Silicon Valley tech entrepreneur and the blue-collar truck driver, are in some ways seeing things in the same way?
Well, I've seen some of these driverless companies, motionless in Nevada, and I've seen the number of people they're hiring still at their remote control center, at their maintenance center. But I do think we have to center workers in the conversation for this to be successful.
Yeah, I hope those conversations are happening in the same rooms when stakeholders can in some ways kind of see each other eye to eye, as opposed to living in so many different circles. I wanted to ask you this, and I'm very curious about this because I've chatted with other Indian American leaders, but I'm curious for you, how and why does your Indian Americanness matter as an elected official in 2023?
Well, I'm proud of my heritage. I think the United States and India are going to be a very strong allies. That is something I care about. And I'm co-chair of the India Caucus. Obviously, being Indian American helps with that. A lot of my values come from a belief in education, a belief in family, a belief in a kindness and respect for the elderly, for people who are strangers, and that is shaped by my faith and by my heritage.
Do you remember, by the way, when you first, in some ways, felt Indian American? Do you remember that sort of series of moments, or was there kind of a few instances, particularly whether that be in Pennsylvania or later, where you realized that, hey, I'm an Indian American?
Well, I realized probably from a very young age. I mean, my parents made sure that we visited India to visit grandparents and family, that I understood the stories of Hindu film Mahabharata and Ramayana and some of the classics, that my parents had Indian American friends that we grew up with, and I grew up speaking English and Hindi, so and watching occasional Hindi movies, so I was aware of my heritage from a very young age.
How has that felt now, being a parent, perhaps, and now in a sort of different era where you're a generation removed from that? How's that felt as a parent, in some ways, kind of now taking that forward in the 21st century as an Indian American parent?
Well, I think it's important to me to come continue some of the traditions. We still celebrate Diwali, and we make our kids aware of India and where their grandparents were born, but it's something that we still have to see how it goes. I mean, every generation that is further away from the immigrant generation, I think, becomes a little less connected, and it'll be for them to decide how much of that they want to embrace.
You mentioned the Congressional Caucus on India and Indian Americans, and you're certainly the co-chair of that, and proudly the co-chair of that. And as the diaspora continues to emerge and evolve, and now Prime Minister Modi is set to visit next month, what are some of the accelerators to strengthening that partnership that you see as priorities?
The scientific partnership should strengthen in terms of joint research on technology, on AI, on biotechnology. That's a key area. The defense partnership needs to improve. We need to be providing India with the critical defense, especially so they could be a counter to China in terms of not letting China become a hegemon. And then the people-to-people partnership matters in terms of just the common values and the sense of the enrichment of that the Indian American community has provided the United States.
How do you balance the Indian American community that has so much interest in their strong ties and tethers back to the subcontinent or to South Asia, when in fact the importance of the engagement here at home is so vital and critical to our kind of national story?
Well, I think the balance is pretty good. I mean, I think you see people in my generation caring still about the U.S.-India relationship, but primarily focused on education here and their neighborhoods and safety and making sure their kids have a good shot and providing philanthropy to the local communities. At the same time, it's important for being Indian American that India and the United States have a good relationship.
I think about some of the things you mentioned with your values and respect for the elderly, and particularly celebrating the elderly. I know that recently you've been, in fact, very vocal about the sadness around how Senator Feinstein's, you know, current contributions are being perceived and her health status. I mean, is that something that is in some ways kind of painful for you to point out, and yet there's such an admiration for someone like her? How have you been threading that needle so far? I imagine that that's been sort of a delicate balance.
It has been a balance, but I think people understand that at some point you just can't fulfill your duties and that you have to be able to do a job. It's a big, awesome responsibility to represent the most populous, most economically prosperous state in the
in the union, 40 million people. And unfortunately, Don Fosdun has been unable to do her job for 3 months and now is barely being able to do her job, the bare minimum. And I think California deserves better.
One of your other heroes, Barbara Lee, is looking to replace her, and particularly within the South Asian American community and the California community. You know, she's been such a pioneer and someone who's brought so much inspiration, you know, to her constituents and to the state. I'm just curious if you reflect on your own journey and some of the things that you've accomplished. Why does supporting her matter to you?
Well, she's been such a champion on issues of war and peace. She was the first war vote against giving a blank check to George W. Bush to be in Afghanistan for 20 years. She spoke out against the war in Iraq. And it's important to me that we have an African-American woman in the Senate. She is really a champion for so many great values.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with Ro Khanna. Stay tuned. Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Parag Marate, president of 49ers Enterprises and EVP of Football Operations, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hey there, I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin now our conversation with United States Congressman Ro Khanna.
Can you tell me one thing? I mean, we always think about the things that we're confident about, that we generate so much enthusiasm around, but how about the struggles? How about the mistakes? How have you been particularly reflective on the things or the steps that you wish you could have had back? How do you take sort of those and fold them into actually how you, in fact, go forward and continue to build trust among your peers and among your constituents?
Well, I think there's a tendency when things don't go your way, when you lose a race or you have a disappointment, to get very anxious, to wonder whether things are going to work out or not, to be fretting over your future. And I realize in retrospect, a lot of that time was wasted energy or wasted anxiety, because over the long run, I've been fortunate, but just being steady, things have worked out, maybe not as I expected, not at the timeline that I would have liked, but they're on their own course. And so that has given me, when I'm at my best, a more a calmness towards recognizing there are aspects of life, many aspects that are beyond one's control, and that if things don't go your way, it's fine to be sad, fine to be anxious, but not to dwell on it and to continue to move on.
For someone like you, Congressman, where do you find sanctuary? What are some of the things that bring you a little bit of that kind of peace, especially in times where there are difficult decisions to make or tough challenges?
I would say my family, my wife, my parents, my brother, close friends, confidants. And of course, spiritually, I try to find time to reflect, maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes every day. And that those are the things that bring me strength.
Your first campaign in 2014, you know, in the 17th district was actually a loss. And I'm so curious how reflecting back then on that time compared to now, how different of a leader are you today compared to back then? And particularly some of the lessons that you learned from that particular experience of losing an election.
Well, I love the idealism I had back then in standing up to the war in Iraq, the boldness in taking on an incumbent of my own party. But now I have a much more thought-out economic philosophy. I have a much better understanding of how the levers of government work. I have a much bigger connection with people in the community of all different backgrounds, people who are in the working class, people who have had economic hardships. And so I just think I'm a more complete, well-rounded person.
Are these kinds of lessons and the resonance of that reflection and your growth as a leader, now that you're part of the Biden-Harris 2024 National Advisory Board, what are some of the things that are going to resonate, particularly to try and help that team get reelected?
I believe I can offer an economic vision in parts of this country about how we bring prosperity to places left out. How do we help the working class? How do we help people really improve their life, getting them childcare, making sure that they're not stuck with medical bills, making sure that they're making a livable wage, dealing with the social media that is challenging their kids, and really look forward to that.
Is there an aspiration at all that you have? I mean, obviously, these are things that are so far away, but your contributions are so strong, and you have so many people who are, I'm sure, celebrating that and activating it. Are there designs that you have on trying to go further with the scope and the reach of what the vision is that you have?
Well, right now I am very excited representing Silicon Valley. I represent an extraordinary district.
Yeah.
Apple, Google, Intel, Yahoo, Tesla, LinkedIn. And I've hit my stride in Congress. 7 years in, I'm on very senior committees, China Committee, the top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee related to AI, on the Oversight Committee, a senior member. But who knows what the future brings. But right now, I feel like I'm right in my prime in Congress.
Right now, and being in your prime, what are some of the really kind of hot priorities on your list, particularly in the next several months, where Congress seems like it's, again, constantly at a standstill?
Well, we really are looking at social media legislation to help have some standard of care on not having addictive algorithms that harm children. Mm. We're looking to have childcare at $10 a day, like Canada, to have some relief for folks. I'm working with Bernie Sanders to eliminate medical debt and see how we can stop people from being harassed if they have medical debt. Those are some of the big ones on our plate.
I wanted to ask you this because, some of your own inspiration for civic engagement and public service was fueled by your grandfather. And I know he was active in India's independence struggle. If he was here today, Congressman Khanna, and perhaps was able to learn of your work, how do you hope he would feel? And what do you hope he'd perhaps say?
I appreciate the question. I think he'd feel proud. I think he'd feel proud to see how far civilization has come, that he fought for the independence of India, and what now his grandson is serving in the Congress of the most powerful country in the world. And I think he'd be hopeful that I would fight for values of justice, values of compassion, values to make sure that every person, not just in America, but around the world, was treated with dignity, and that we have a very long way to go as a humanity to reach that goal.
If you think of that conversation, do you have equally important, perhaps, questions that you would want to ask him?
Well, I would just be curious in some of the details about his life, his struggles, how he spent the time in jail, what gave him hope. What are things that he hoped for India and the world, and how he would see the world today, and how he thinks about what India and the world have become.
When you think of that also, what are some of the things that give you optimism and joy?
Well, I love spending time with my family, with my kids. I enjoy football and basketball, obviously, every now and then following the 49ers, the Cleveland Browns, where my wife's from, and following the Warriors. And then I watch occasionally television, starting to watch Ted Lasso. I know I'm behind the curve on that, but occasionally I'll watch streaming on Apple TV or Netflix.
Well, I hope you're going to get some time to catch up, but we're eager and excited, enthusiastic for all the things that you're doing. Congressman Khanna, thank you so much. I hope we can share another chance to connect again, perhaps next time over chai and Indian food in Fremont.
Would love that. I'm always up for good masala chai, and appreciate what you're doing. Appreciate your voice and your podcast.
Thank you so much, Congressman. And as always, an important reminder that no matter where you are, please register to vote. Go to vote.gov for more information. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.